Imagine this scene, a conflict, so intense, so unbalanced, it's almost hard to believe.
Right.
You've got this small force, maybe 200 soldiers.
Tiny, really?
And they're facing an enemy that outnumbers them, maybe 20 to 1. For days.
Just relentless pressure.
Running battles, they're outmaneuvered, probably outgunned in many ways. And then their allies, the local army, the peacekeepers, they just vanish.
Gone. It's an incredible story of survival, yes, but also strategic mistakes and just, well, astounding bravery. It really tested South Africa's whole role in African security.
And that's exactly what we're digging into today, isn't it? The battle in Bangui, Central African Republic, March 2013.
Exactly. We're using Helmut Rimmer-Heitmann's book, The Battle in Bangui, The Untold Inside Story, as our main source. It's incredibly detailed.
So our mission today isn't just the shooting, the tactics.
No, much more than that. We need to unpack the geopolitics that got them there, the huge decisions made way up the chain, and, you know, the really big lessons learned about what the military could actually do and what the political will really was.
Okay, let's get into it. The main event. It's almost unbelievable, like you said. 3 days, March 22nd to 24th, 2013.
Yeah.
About 200 South African soldiers fighting these running battles outside Bangui against, what was the estimate, 4,000.
Yeah.
7,000 Salika fighters.
Somewhere in that range, yes. Thousands. Anyway, well armed. And while this is happening, the Kar Army, FACA, and the regional force, FOMAC,
just evaporated.
Utterly. Left the South Africans completely exposed.
And the intensity. You mentioned the munitions count. It's staggering.
It really is. Just listen to these figures. Over 12,000 rounds of 12.7 mil machine gun ammo.
Wow.
More than 60 rockets from 107-millimeter launchers, 200 bombs from 81-millimeter mortars, and just thousands and thousands of rifle rounds.
How much is that in total?
It adds up to about 10 tons of munitions fired off in just over 2 days by about 200 guys.
10 tons. You could barely imagine the noise, the chaos, just constant close fight.
Relentless. Absolutely relentless.
And the cost. It was high for the South Africans. 13 killed, 27 wounded. Heartbreaking.
Terribly so. But then you look at the other side. Estimated Salika casualties. Up to 800 killed?
800.
Possibly. And maybe several hundred more dying later from wounds because there just wasn't medical care for them.
That contrast is, it tells a story in itself, doesn't it?
Mm.
About the training, the discipline of that South African unit.
Absolutely. Heitmann compares it to the British 3rd Paras in Helmand, Afghanistan, back in 2006. They had 1,200 soldiers, lost 15 killed, 46 wounded over 6 months.
And they had backup?
Oh, yeah. Tanks, artillery, air power. These guys in Bangui had none of that. It just underscores the sheer scale of the fight those 200 soldiers were in.
What's truly amazing is that they didn't break.
Not at all. That small force kept its cohesion the entire time, fought exceptionally well. It's incredibly rare under that kind of pressure.
And even the French acknowledged it.
They did. The French force at Bangui Airport held a formal parade for the fallen South Africans when they left. A real mark of respect.
But ultimately, South Africa pulled out after the government fell.
Yes. There was apparently a request made to bring in a stronger South African force to maybe stabilize things, but the French commander at the airport, well, he denied it, said there was no mandate for it, and the airport was the only way in or out, really.
Okay, so that's the brutal reality of the battle. But the big question remains, why were they there at all? How did they end up in Bangui?
Right, the why. The formal reason was a defense cooperation agreement signed back on February 11th, 2007.
What did that agreement cover?
It was focused on cooperation on peace and stability and the training and capacity building of military personnel. That was the official line.
But the story starts even earlier, doesn't it?
It does. Back in December 2006, the Kar president at the time, Bazes, approached the South African president, Mbeki, at an African Union meeting.
And what did Bazes want?
He basically wanted South Africa's help to become less dependent on France. He asked for military assistance, yes, but also for business investment.
Interesting mix. So, a direct potential request. But I read the South African military, the NDF, they weren't exactly keen.
That's right. They were reluctant. They felt, you know, already underfunded, not really well equipped to start helping others on that scale. They had their own problems.
So who pushed it through?
According to the source, the Secretary for Defense pushed for it. Basically saying it was a presidential decision and instruction from the ministry. They tried to get other government departments involved, like trade and industry.
Did that work?
Not really. Apparently, there wasn't much interest from them in the CRR. So the military had its doubts, but the political direction from the top made it happen.
And what did South Africa actually do based on this agreement? What aid materialized?
Well, not as much as you might think. There was a close protection team for President Bozize for a couple of years, until 2008.
Okay.
Some training happened, both in the Carrara and back in South Africa. And there was a plan to donate surplus equipment.
Did that happen?
Mostly no. Maybe one or two Rattel 90 armored vehicles for local training, but that was about it. And the training program itself, it apparently struggled with bad administration on the Kakar side, only ended up training about 1,300 FACA soldiers total.
So not a huge impact from the training side.
Relatively small, yeah.
Now, there's always talk, especially around deployments like this, about political business interests. Was that a factor here, according to the military planners?
Heitman notes that while there was much discussion about those kinds of allegations, the officers actually doing the planning, they didn't see evidence of specific deals driving it.
But there was a strategic reason.
Oh, yes. A clear strategic rationale. Building contacts, influence in a country right next door to the DRC. That makes sense, given the DRC's long-term economic potential for South Africa. The military was seen as, you know, one tool the state could use to advance those broader national interests.
Not necessarily individual pockets being lined.
Not visibly, from the perspective of the planners described in the source, no.
And the Carrara itself. This instability wasn't new, was it? It has a pretty troubled history.
Oh, absolutely. A long, tragic history of conflict, coup, rebellions, ever since independence. Bozize himself came to power overthrowing President Padese.
With outside help?
Explicit backing from Chad and Sudan, and sort of implicit support from France, it seems. Then there were more rebellions, like the UFDR one in 2006, where France even intervened militarily. Peace deals were signed.
But they didn't stick.
Exactly. None brought lasting stability. The place was a tinderbox, really.
So given that background, the Salika offensive in December 2012, what was different about it? Why did it catch people off guard?
It was the speed and the determination. They took over 2/3 of the country in just 19 days.
Wow. The roads are terrible there, aren't they?
Exactly. 500 kilometers over awful roads. And here's the real puzzle, Heitman points out. Salika used the exact same routes that Chadian forces were supposedly using to deploy to help the CAR government.
Wait, really? That sounds suspicious.
It raised a lot of questions. It suggested much better capabilities for Salika, who was training them. Sudan was floated as a good first guess.
And the local forces. FACA. Micropax.
FACA mostly just withdrew quickly. And Micropax, the regional peacekeepers, they completely failed to stop the rebels. It was a rapid collapse.
Okay, so the rebels are advancing incredibly fast. The situation looks dire. President Zuma must have been under enormous pressure.
Immense pressure. By Christmas Day 2012, South African intelligence was warning about danger to the small training team already there, the 28 guys.
But they didn't think the rebels would reach Bangui initially.
No, that initial assessment was, as the source puts it, over-optimistic. They thought maybe 1,000 to 1,200 poorly armed rebels. Wrong.
So what were the options on the table then? Pull them out.
Tactically, the military headquarters, joint ops, preferred withdrawal, get the team out safely.
What?
But there was a big problem. Several tons of South African weapons, ammo, and equipment stored in the presidential palace. You couldn't just leave that.
Right. That could fall into the wrong hands.
Exactly. And strategically, pulling out looked bad. It could undermine South Africa's image as a reliable security partner in Africa. Maybe even encourage threats elsewhere if SA looked like it would cut and run.
A classic dilemma. Immediate safety versus long-term credibility.
Precisely. And then Bozize made a direct appeal to Zuma, didn't he?
He did. At the end of December. Reminded him about that 2007 agreement, the MOU.
And pointedly mentioned the promised weapons that hadn't been delivered.
Which put Zuma in a real bind.
A total quandary. Saying no would look like reneging on a formal agreement. Bad for the image, especially with SA campaigning for roles in the AU and UN Security Council. Plus, the AU, which SA helped found, had a strong anti-coup stance.
So it wasn't just about image. There were wider strategic concerns, too.
Definitely. Several big ones. First, Salika wasn't unified. They'd likely fragment after taking power, causing more instability.
Spillover.
Almost certainly into the northern DRC, which is fragile anyway, and a SADC partner with security ties to South Africa.
And the Sudan connection.
If Sudan gained control over the Carrara, they could support nasty groups like the LRA and ADF attacking Uganda from the DRC. That could destabilize the whole region, including where SANFF peacekeepers already were in North Kivu.
What else?
Impact on the new nation of South Sudan, Khartoum, wanted to destabilize it. And they share a long border with SAR. Plus, ripples outwards to Chad, Cameroon, Republic of Congo. And then the practical problem.
Getting the equipment out.
Yeah, how do you pull tons of weapons out quietly without sparking the very conflict you're trying to avoid? Very tricky.
But could the Sandy F even handle another mission? Weren't they stretched thin?
That was the huge constraint. Underfunded for years, already in Darfur and the DRC, plus recently given border protection duties back home.
And the airlift problem again.
A critical weakness. The Air Force just didn't have the strategic airlift to move troops and heavy gear quickly over 3,500 kilometers. They'd seen this vulnerability just weeks before with the M23 rebels and Goma SA troops. There had no way out if the airport was taken.
A clear warning sign.
You'd think so. The military was definitely stretched.
So Zuma gets briefed on all this, the risks, the limitations. What was the final decision?
He decided South Africa must see things through. Couldn't run away, couldn't sacrifice the political investment already made.
He made a stand on principle.
He framed it that way, saying Africa could not afford yet another round of coups and rebellions, declared first Mali and now this, it must stop here.
So the training team stays.
And a protection force would be sent in.
What was their specific mission?
Protect SA interests, the training team, secure those weapons and ammo so rebels couldn't get them, and protect any SA citizens. But crucially,
yes,
the force commander was also told to stiffen FACA forces if the rebels attacked. Basically, prop up the local army's defense.
That's a significant escalation from just protection.
It is.
And the force they sent, paratroopers, special forces, they thought that would be enough to deter the rebels.
Initially, yes. The thinking was this small but capable SA force, plus FACA, plus FOMAC, plus the French already there, that combined presence should make Salika back off.
And did it.
Surprisingly, at first it seemed to. Salika halted their advance, agreed to negotiate. The source calls it an elegant sufficiency of force. For that moment, it looked like it worked.
But deploying even that small force wasn't easy.
No, the deployment itself, while commendably quick, they left January 2nd, 2013, was also, quote, embarrassing.
Why embarrassing?
Because even for that small group, South Africa had to charter aircraft. They didn't have enough of their own military transport planes. That lack of strategic airlift was a glaring issue right away.
Okay, so they arrive. Where did they set up base?
They were given a former police training center, north side of Bangui. They got it ready quickly, but the location was terrible for defense.
If so.
Overlooked by higher ground, surrounded by dense bush, civilian houses right nearby, Heitman calls it singularly unsuited for defense.
Not ideal. What did the commander do once they landed?
He immediately started patrols, reconnaissance, actually built up a good relationship with the locals nearby who felt safer with them around.
Smart move. And contingency planning.
Yes. He reconnoitered defensive lines further out, codenamed black, green, blue, yellow lines. Deployed tactical intelligence teams.
But he was stretched thin.
Incredibly thin. Dealing with tactics, liaising with FACA, FOMAC, the French, even directly with President Bouzaïs himself, and crucially,
no central command.
No combined multinational headquarters. Coordination between all these different forces was extremely difficult, almost impossible. He was largely on his own, command-wise.
And how did the rebels react specifically to the South Africans arriving?
Immediately and very negatively. Heitman says vituperative. They called the South Africans mercenaries, demanded they leave.
Which suggests the South Africans were seen as a real obstacle.
Exactly. The source calls it a backhanded compliment. And soon they figured out why Salika seemed so competent.
Who was behind it?
One of their senior officers was a General Mahamat Nuri, former Chad army officer, key planner in previous attacks on Chad's capital in Djadjanamana. That explained a lot about Salika's sudden effectiveness.
Ah, okay. The puzzle pieces start fitting.
Well,
so negotiations are happening, but things felt tense. Were there warning signs?
Definitely growing concerns. Bouzaïs himself apparently suspected France, and Chad had decided he was finished.
And the South Africans on the ground?
They doubted Chad's real intentions, too, especially seeing rebels using the same roads as Chadian troops. Plus, unconfirmed reports started coming in. Maybe FOMAC vehicles were actually smuggling rebels. Little things adding up.
Then the ceasefire broke.
Yes. March 22nd, Salika forces captured Damara and Bosangoa. That was it. The battle was on.
And how did it start for the South Africans? I heard the first warning was strange.
Incredibly strange and deceptive. With no way to see for themselves, like with a drone, the first report the SA commander got was from a Chadian army unit saying they were being overrun, but with no casualties reported, which sounded fishy. Combined with FOMAC being silent, the commander suspected it might be a false alarm.
So he treated it as
a training opportunity sent a special forces patrol out to the Black Line, about 27 kilometers north. Almost unbelievable looking back.
And it definitely wasn't training. What happened to that patrol?
No, it was brutal. They passed a Feka checkpoint and suspected later the checkpoint tipped off the enemy. Suddenly, they drove into a 300-meter L-shaped ambush.
How many attackers?
Estimated 200. Well-armed, waiting just 10 meters off the road.
Instant chaos.
Immediate casualties. They had trailers they had to unhitch under heavy fire. Hand grenades coming in. Took them 15 minutes of intense fighting just to break out of the kill zone.
That tells you immediately what kind of enemy you're facing.
Absolutely. Disciplined, well-armed, tactically smart. Not just rebels.
And things escalated quickly after that. The other positions came under attack.
Yes. The parachute company holding the blue line soon got hit with mortars, heavy machine guns, RPGs, full-scale attack.
They hold.
They fought fiercely. Platoons got pushed back, then counterattacked and retook ground. Incredible resilience. There was a Fakker Rattel 90 and a BMP nearby.
Did they help?
Their involvement was limited and pretty ineffective. The paratroopers were basically fighting alone.
What about the Mopoko River Bridge? That sounds like a key point.
Absolutely vital. The commander realized a major rebel force was heading for it and recalled the Special Forces team to try and hold it.
Could they stop them?
They tried desperately. Attempted to demolish the bridge, but couldn't. Called for support from Feka, FOMAC, French. Nothing came. They ended up engaging hundreds of rebels, at least 15 technicals. Those pickup trucks with guns mounted on them.
Any air support?
A Feka Mi-25 helicopter showed up, but its help was ineffective. It was a desperate fight for that bridge.
So even when the Special Forces arrived, the numbers were just too much.
Way too much. Even the combined force was too small. They kept getting outflanked, surrounded. Salika had 107-millimeter rockets.
Devastating weapons.
Caused massive casualties. But Salika just kept feeding in more troops. It got so bad, the force commander himself was actually loading a 107-millimeter rocket launcher at one point.
That's desperate. Shows how close it was.
Extremely close. Ammunition running low, fighting sometimes at 50 meters. They were being pushed back into Bangui itself, risking civilian lives.
So they had to pull back.
Order came for a last fire belt action, basically. Lay down maximum fire to cover a withdrawal. They broke contact, but had 12 wounded, including the SF commander.
And the paratroopers were still out at the blue line?
Yes, a critical moment. The chief of staff was sent racing back to get the paras moving before the rebels cut them off at the Y junction where the roads met.
That sounds like a nightmare withdrawal for the paratroopers.
Absolutely terrifying, trying to break contact from an enemy maybe 10 times their size, fighting in the dark. The source describes the sound of incoming fire like hail on a tin roof.
Heavy weapons.
Oh, yeah. They lost vehicles. Some hand-to-hand fighting even happened. He had to escape in small groups. One large group made a final run for it when the moon went behind a cloud. Pure guts.
And while that's happening, the main base is also under attack.
Yes. About 1,500 rebels attacked the base itself. The SF group that had pulled back from the bridge had to stay and defend it, along with cooks, clerks, everyone, even though the base was basically indefensible. That fight went on for hours.
Unbelievable pressure.
Hmm.
Then comes this really strange moment. The ceasefire call. How did that happen if it's the chaos?
It's one of the most bizarre parts of the story. A South African major from the original training team somehow got into the base during the fighting.
Ow.
Unclear. But he reported he had a call from the enemy general. The SA force commander then got on the line, spoke directly to the Salika general commanding the forces around the city.
What did they talk about?
The SA commander proposed terms to stop the fighting, and the Salika general, he was apparently courteous, friendly even.
Friendly? While attacking them?
Yeah. He said, "We did not come to fight you," and blamed the fighting on poor discipline among his troops.
Okay. That's strange enough.
But then comes the real shocker. The general casually mentions he used to be an officer in the Kar Presidential Guard and then says, "By the way, I was trained by you."
Wait, what? He was trained by the South Africans?
Apparently, yes. Early on in that 2007 training program, before he defected to the rebels, the man leading the attack had been trained by the very people he was now fighting.
That must have been a jaw-dropping moment.
Yeah.
And it confirms the enemy wasn't just ragtag.
Absolutely. It cemented it. These guys weren't just militia. Many wore proper uniforms, webbing, body armor, carried new AK-47s, had heavy stuff like 23-millimeter cannons.
And not all local.
Clearly not. Many spoke with Chadian accents or had, as the source puts it, distinctly Arabic features. This was a serious, well-equipped force.
So after this surreal phone call, what happened? Did the fighting stop?
The general agreed to allow the South Africans freedom of movement. With ammo critically low, FACA gone, FOMAC vanished, the SA commander decided disengagement was the only option.
Were all the soldiers accounted for by then?
Eventually, yes. The final toll was confirmed. 13 killed, 27 wounded. The missing were found.
How did they get out?
After the general left, things got dicey again for a bit with uncontrolled rebel elements riffraff. But crucially, one FOMAC company did help. They provided trucks to move the wounded to the airport.
Well, there was a plane waiting.
Yes. An SA Air Force Hercules was pre-positioned. It evacuated the wounded. Then the whole remaining force moved to the airport, helped the French secure it.
And then home.
The fallen were flown back March 25th, most of a force on the 27th. South Africa officially ended its mission in Kerar on April 4th.
The collective bravery is clear, but there were some incredible individual stories too, weren't there? Real moments of ingenuity under fire.
Absolutely astounding stories. Like the tactical intelligence team cut off deep in enemy territory.
What did they do?
They buried the sensitive equipment, then evaded rebels, moving 16 kilometers through the bush, somehow making it safely to the airport. Incredible field craft and nerve.
16 kilometers dodging rebels.
Wow.
And the paratroopers who got separated?
Yeah, another amazing one. He managed to get hold of civilian clothes, then somehow found a phone and called his home base, 44 Para Regiment, back in Bloemfontein, South Africa.
He called South Africa from behind enemy lines.
Told them where he was. They relayed the info, and a French patrol eventually picked him up. The presence of mind, incredible.
And the female soldier from the training team. Her story sounds like a movie plot.
It really does. She was alone in her office when the fighting erupted. She calmly gathered all the operational cash from the safe, packed it in a suitcase.
Then what?
Changed into civilian clothes, walked out, and somehow hitched a ride with Salika rebels through their checkpoints.
No way.
Yes. And delivered the cash, every cent accounted for, to her commander at the airport. Just astonishing courage and resourcefulness.
These stories are incredible, but they also highlight the desperate situation. Brings us back to the bigger picture. The lessons learned.
And there were many critical lessons, unfortunately repeating some past ones. Intelligence was a major failure. The initial intel might have been okay, but it was wildly out of date by the time the fighting started. Plus, a real lack of liaison and coordination with other countries' intelligence agencies.
Range equipment, capability gaps.
Huge gaps. No aerial reconnaissance, UAVs, drones would have been invaluable.
Like the Seeker or Kivit system South Africa has.
Exactly. The force itself was too light and too lightly armed for sustained combat. It was meant as a protection unit. The army lacked air transportable fighting vehicles or artillery they could bring in.
What else?
That lack of a combined HQ made coordinated defense virtually impossible. Not enough vehicles for mobility, no armored vehicles besides ambulances, and air support.
If only they'd had Royvac helicopters.
A few Royvac attack helicopters or even Oryx utility choppers with side guns could have made a crucial difference. But again, the Air Force couldn't deploy them quickly because...
No strategic airlift.
Precisely. Not enough planes, not the right types to fly in reinforcements, heavy gear, or get troops out quickly. A fundamental weakness.
So major military capability issues. But the source points to a deeper political lesson, too.
A critical one. Governments use their military for national interests. Political, economic, sure. But there has to be a clear separation of national interests from those of individuals or ruling parties.
Transparency, basically.
Yes. Any benefits need to clearly come from protecting national interests, not be the reason for the deployment itself. The source argues the SAR agreement wasn't handled properly, lacked transparency, which fueled suspicion about private interests.
And South Africa had been warned before about these capability gaps, right? This wasn't the first time.
No, sadly not. Heitman points out more than adequate warning. The ambush in Darfur in October 2012. The M23 rebels taking Goma in November 2012, leaving SA troops vulnerable. The signs were there that defense capabilities didn't match regional ambitions.
So when things go wrong like this, who bears the blame? The soldiers performed heroically.
The source is emphatic on this. Blame doesn't go to the soldiers or junior leaders. Their performance was quite outstanding. Not even the generals, really, who can only do the best with what they have.
So it points higher up.
Directly at the politicians who starve the defense force financially and then expect it to work miracles.
Which presents a very stark choice.
A fundamental choice for South Africa. Either commit to doing these regional missions properly or don't do them. And if you do commit,
you have to fund it.
You must provide our troops with the equipment needed. Urgently acquire proper transport aircraft for vehicles. Get those Ravox and Oryx deployable. get tanker aircraft for refueling. You can't keep sending troops into harm's way without the right tools.
Because the ultimate cost?
Yeah.
It's not measured in currency.
No. The final brutal lesson. There is no such thing as military operations on the cheap. What is saved in cash will be paid for in blood.
And in Bangui, that price was paid. We should remember the 13 South African soldiers who lost their lives there.
Absolutely. Corporal Makadi, Darius Sikamela, Corporal Ntabaleng, Andrew Mogorosi, Lance Corporal Daniel Sela Malara, Lance Corporal Lucas Mahapi Chike,
Rifleman Olisego Maxwell Herzog Labatlang, Rifleman Zamani Jim Mixasana, Rifleman Zelani Dlemini, Rifleman Vusumuzi Joseph Fungalika,
Rifleman Karabo Edwin Machika, Rifleman Kamatso Paul Masenga, Rifleman Malasani Samuel Fulo, Rifleman Matsumai William Bojane, and Rifleman Tabiso Anthon Firmana.
Their sacrifice really underscores the human cost of these decisions.
It does. So you've journeyed with us through this really harrowing story, the battle in Bangui. What really stands out, I think, is this contrast.
Between the incredible courage on the ground.
Amazing individual bravery, tactical skill against impossible odds.
And the bigger picture.
And the stark reality of the strategic decisions, the resource limitations, that whole complex web of political interests playing out. It's a critical look at what international engagement really means.
The human cost of these geopolitical choices.
Exactly. And the absolute need to match your ambitions as a nation with what you can actually deliver capability-wise.
So it leaves us with a pretty heavy question, doesn't it? In today's unstable world, with everything so interconnected, do nations really grasp the true cost in money? Yes, but more importantly, in lives of the roles they want to play.
It's a vital question.
And what happens when that gap, the gap between what you aspire to do and what you're actually equipped to do, ends up being paid for in blood?